Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern. Last week, the Missouri Symphony Society kicked off its annual Hot Summer Nights music series at the Stevens Lake Park Amphitheater. The park may not be the first place that comes to mind when you think about classical music in Columbia. In the past, talking about the Missouri Symphony Society usually meant talking about the fate of the Missouri Theater. But now the theater's future is comfortably in the hands of the university, and so the Symphony Society is able to put energy into other things, like expanding Hot Summer Nights to multiple venues around Columbia. The community concerts are part of an ongoing effort to get more people involved with the Hot Summer Nights and with symphony in general in mid-Missouri. With us today to talk about that effort and about classical music in the community, Kirk Trevor is the music director and conductor for the Missouri Symphony. Welcome to our program, Kirk Trevor.
Thank you, Ruben, very much.
Glad to have you back on our program. We also have with us by phone Jennifer Barnett. She is the director of education and community partnerships for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. Her organization has done a lot of work to engage its community with classical music performance. Welcome to our program, Jennifer Barnett.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you with us. We'll also hear a bit of music performed by a pair of musicians from the Missouri Symphony today, and we hope that you and our audience will join the conversation as well. What kind of experiences have you had with classical music performances here in mid-Missouri? Give us a call, 573-882-8925, or send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. A quick reminder that our live discussion takes place Monday afternoons at 2. And let's get started with this question. Kirk, why go out to a park to perform when there's a beautifully renovated Missouri Theater? It has air conditioning, it has good acoustics, it has no mosquitoes. Why out in the park?
Because that's where the community lives. The community is a broad-reaching, far-reaching community of adults and children and dogs, and we wanted to find a place that had an ambient that was non-threatening, that was free, that was in a beautiful location, and it would enable people to listen to great music, not only classical but popular, in an environment that was entertaining, engaging, and hopefully was non-threatening. I think that the thing about summer music, and we talk about the park as if it's just, you know, a big open space and we were in the middle of a field. It wasn't quite like that, but they've got a beautiful new facility there, the Stevens Lake Park Amphitheater. It's a hard name to get your tongue around.
It's a lot of words and syllables.
But, yeah, great facility, and I think we'll get better. I mean, there's a few things that can improve there, but it was a great way for us to meet the general community at large, and lots of families came, and it was a great way for us to introduce the eclectic nature of the Hot Summer Nights Festival.
Right, and how did it go? I mean, what sort of response
great.
Did you get
I think
last week?
Chris Stevens, who's with the head of the Office of Cultural Affairs, said it's the largest crowd they've had at the park. Obviously, it's relatively new, but there probably were 500, 600 people there, and that was really great for us because it was a chance for the word of mouth is the best way for people to get the word out about Hot Summer Nights, and this was a wonderful evening. It was a beautiful evening as it happened, and the orchestra had been in 24 hours, and we'd had two rehearsals, and it was just a great feeling, you know.
Mm-hmm. And is this the first time that Hot Summer Nights has been out in the community like this?
No, well, we used to play at Twilight Festival, which was a kind of Thursday nights, and we used to do the same thing, have one concert that preceded the main opening night. But the Twilight Festival is a little harder, you know, there's something about playing in downtown on concrete as opposed to playing in the middle of a beautiful lakeside park. You know, with grass and trees all around you, as opposed to a court building. So I always felt that Twilight Festival for us, where there was a lot of other noises going on, you know, restaurants close by and traffic, was much less conducive for us having an engaging experience with our audience than we do here at the amphitheater.
And what about the acoustics? I mean, in an outdoor space like that, is the music
the
same sort of music that you'd get inside of a
I mean,
theater?
We weren't trying to play Mahler 8 for you know, so I mean, or Tchaikovsky or Beethoven 9. The reality is that the acoustics, hopefully, as the city looks at this facility and realizes what a gem it can be, they'll realize that they can spend, not too much money and rapidly improve the quality of sound that comes off of that stage. It's a fantastic stage itself. The stage is big enough for a large orchestra. They've got a back wall, but they just don't have a canopy that projects sound outwards into the grass and into the amphitheater itself. So I'm hoping that, maybe somebody will come up with some money or donate some money to enable that facility to be upgraded. I mean, it's already new, so upgraded just means adding a shell that will really project the sound, maybe some sidewalls, because everything else is perfect about it.
Interesting. Now, I mentioned in the intro, and I think this is right, I mean, this is one of multiple concerts that are going to be outside of the Missouri Theater, right?
Yes. We have a series this year I called Hear Us Here, which is just I went around the community and tried to find places that would like to have a concert. We have had a relationship with Lenora Woods community last year, so we're going to be back at the Lenora Woods, which our youth orchestras played this year at the Senior Activities Center. And so this was an obvious relationship that was natural for us to make an inroad into our senior community, knowing that many of them could not get to the theater late at night. They didn't drive anymore, and for us to go to them and to bring them the music and the beauty that hopefully, they've missed over their lives, not being able to get to the theater recently. So that was important. And the hospital community, there's a new healing garden at Boone County Hospital that my wife just opened the other day. And we used to have a wonderful relationship with Boone County Hospital when I first came here and doing a little work in the wards. And so I'm glad that we're back there. They've got this beautiful facility there. Places like Douglas Park and the library. So it's my hope that we'll eventually run out of evenings and we can't play at every place in town. But my whole purpose of having the community series was to let people know that we were not just a 9th Street Missouri Theater Orchestra, that we truly wanted to be part of the community, and that the community outside of downtown Columbia had an opportunity. We had an opportunity to meet that audience and not restrict ourselves to somewhat, I hate to use the word elitist, but I think that a lot of people have felt that symphony orchestras are rather elite institution, right, and they play in quote-unquote concert halls that can be rather threatening to people at times.
We'll come back to that in a second. Let me just remind everyone that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the Hot Summer Nights music series and classical music performance in Columbia. Joining me in the studio is Kirk Trevor, music director and conductor for the Missouri Symphony. On the phone, we also have Jennifer Barnett, director of education and community partnerships for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. For those of you in our audience, what ideas do you have for making classical music more appealing or more approachable for people in the audience? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. You can call in with questions for our panelists as well if you'd like to do that. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can join our online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Jennifer, I want to bring you into this because going out in the community is your entire job, right?
It is, yes.
And how does what Kirk is describing going on with this Hot Summer Nights Festival fit with what you're doing in Knoxville? It's a little bit bigger of a market that you have there.
Yes, we In talking about series that are out and about in the community, we just finished our symphony season in May, and we ended that up with two particular concerts that are similar to what you're doing with Hot Summer Nights. One of those is on Market Square, which is kind of a downtown venue for us. And we saw the audience for that concert this year grow from 200 in the previous season to over 1,000 this year. So I think that
wow.
those outdoor concerts are something that people are really looking for.
And what did you do to get that number to be five times what it was?
We actually worked in conjunction with the city of Knoxville this year. They have had an ongoing music series that's happening on Thursday nights. And so the scheduling worked out, and we just happened to be a part of that music series. And I think that extra word of mouth and extra promotion that we received from the city, as well as our own internal promotions, helped that grow. It also helped that we had beautiful weather that evening. And I think a lot of people enjoy that kind of relaxed atmosphere and a little bit lighter classical music that we normally do for that performance.
I mean, that's one thing that Kirk just mentioned is, you know, that kind of threatening environment of the elite concert hall and the music that gets performed in that. Jennifer, you just mentioned that the music is lighter, too. I mean, how much of it is the venue and how much of it is the type of music that's getting played?
I think all music can be accessible when we take the steps to educate our audience about it. I think people in general feel a little bit more relaxed and a little bit more open to that when they're able to kind of relax with their children and their pets and their picnic that they've brought out for the evening. And I think that makes them a little bit more open even to what we have to say. So I think it's a combination of both of those two things.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that you know, the famous saying of the last few years has been with the demise, the so-called demise of classical music in America, which I don't buy for 1 minute, but the saying is it's not Beethoven that's the problem, it's the way we present Beethoven that's been the problem. And I think that that's kind of what we're talking about here. It's the way that we present classical music that is important as much as what we play. Obviously, if we look at Central Park or Grant Park in Chicago, huge audiences, we're talking about, you know, 50,000 people coming out to sit under the stars and listen to Andrea Bocelli or classical music or pop music. I mean, the reality is that the outdoor concept for classical music is not so strange, I think, for Americans, especially as technology has improved so rapidly over the last 20 years to make sound systems so good and make the quality of music listening so much better than it was in the days when you had one microphone stuck in front of the orchestra and a couple of speakers. And I know that's certainly true in Knoxville, and how Market Square has improved from that one little speaker that used to be in front of that shell there. But I think it's the way we present classical music. And I hate using the word classical because, you know, then it becomes what's classical and what's pop. So I think it's all, you know, art music, and whether it's William Tell or popular or music from Evita, I mean, the reality is that Lucas and I have talked about, you know, what makes a great pops program, and it's this blend of mixing the classics with the popular.
I think it also makes the musicians themselves a little bit more accessible. In the traditional concert hall, they're on the stage, the audience is in the auditorium, but in some of these outdoor venues, they actually have the chance to interact directly with musicians as they're leaving the stage area, as they're coming into the concert, as they're all walking to their cars afterwards. So that's one of the things we've really looked at in Knoxville as a PR campaign, is helping people in our community know our musicians. They live here, they work here, they shop at the same grocery store. And I think anytime you can come into a concert situation and think, oh, you know, that's Steve, I know him, he's my neighbor three doors down, it makes it a little bit more inherently accessible in that way, too.
And it's a question of relevance, isn't it? For a musician to feel a relevant part of the community. And I know in Knoxville, the musicians became well-known enough for them to have a presence in the town. Our problem sometimes here is that the musicians are only here for 7 or 8 weeks. And, you know, they're here, and 24 concerts in 6 weeks is a very intense period.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kirk, you're talking just about the Hot Summer Nights musicians,
festival,
right?
Our musicians, you know, the Missouri Symphony is primarily that orchestra that comes from all over the United States to play and live here for those 6 weeks, or 8 weeks. But you know, that's one-sixth of everybody's life that's mm-hmm. been coming here for 15 years. So they do feel that Columbia is their home away from home if mm-hmm. they spend one-sixth of their life here. So many of our musicians have a sense of community as well, and they don't want to feel like transients or in transit, but they'd like to feel part of the community. And I know in Knoxville, sometimes it's frustrating for musicians because there is this kind of sense of divide between audience. You know, the stage is kind of raised about 4 feet, and somehow the musicians never get this feeling that they're part of the community that they're in.
Right. We talked about education a little bit, and we've talked about the musicians. And earlier this morning, we had two musicians come into the studio to play some music for us. They're musicians that are with the Missouri Symphony. And I want to do a little bit with this clip of music. It's a piece by Bizet that we're going to start with mm-hmm. here. Now, Kirk, you've programmed this into the series.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the piece and why you put it in.
It's going to appear actually on a number of different programs, but the on-track from Act 3 of Carmen, it's a beautiful duet in some ways. Orchestrally, it's still the harp and the flute are very prominent, but it's written for full orchestra. Here we're going to hear just the flute and harp version. But, you know, it's opera is an even more elitist format probably than even symphony music. So sometimes you can kind of approach, you can get people to take some of their fear away from opera by playing them orchestral music that comes from operas and tell them that, you know, it's not just about singing, but there's some beautiful music as well. And we're going to play this piece actually on our Bluff Your Way into Classical Music concert next Sunday. The full title is Bluff Your Way into Classical Music, or How Many Conductors Did It Take to Conduct One Concert? Because actually there are going to be 7 conductors on this program, and I'm just going to sit back and do the sport trivia quiz during the rest of the narrate the concert and do the sports trivia quiz for guys that are only there because their wives made them go there. So between each piece, there's going to be a sport trivia quiz.
Now, help us understand for a second. You know, we talk about appreciating classical music. It's something that is always kind of put into the mix here and trying to get people to be able to appreciate it. For those who are not familiar with this piece or with classical music in general, what are they supposed to be listening for? How does one appreciate the piece we're about to hear?
Beautiful song. You know, the thing about some classical music is it's either about rhythm or it's about a great tune or about some drama. In this particular case, it's a beautiful tune. It could have been written by Madonna or probably more likely Eric Carmen or somebody like that, but because he did a lot of stuff with classical music. But this is a tune that has appeared in movies. It's the kind of music that we actually probably hear much more often than we think, especially if we're moviegoers. But that's a whole nother conversation. But I think it's, you know, what should you be listening to? You know, it's like looking at a beautiful picture. You know, appreciate its beauty. Don't try to overanalyze it. You know, don't try and understand a composer's deep meaning because there probably isn't one. Right. It's about something beautiful.
Jennifer, anything to add to that before we play the piece?
I think that Kirk is absolutely right. You just have to find what speaks to you from a particular piece of music, or maybe it doesn't. And that doesn't mean you don't like classical music. It just means you need to try a different composer.
Right.
So.
Okay, so let's go ahead and play the piece. It's the on-track
from
Act 3 from Bizet's Carmen, and it's being performed by Alexander Vizutsev and Marie. Did I say that even close to right?
We'll get there, yeah.
Okay.
The hardest thing about our orchestra is pronouncing everybody's name.
Well, Kirk, I should let you introduce the players.
Alexander Vizutsev and my wife, Maria Duhova-Trevor.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. The piece you just heard is from Bizet's Carmen. It's the entr'acte from Act 3, performed by two members of the Missouri Symphony Society, who were in our studio earlier today to record that. Today's program, we're talking about the Hot Summer Nights music series and classical music performance in Columbia. Joining me in the studio is Kirk Trevor, the music director and conductor for the Missouri Symphony. On the phone, we also have Jennifer Barnett, the director of education and community partnerships for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. For those of you in our audience, what would our guest, Kirk Trevor, have to do to get you to attend a symphony performance? We'd love to hear your ideas. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Now, that piece, you mentioned opera fans before. I actually am a bit of an opera fan, and that is my favorite piece out of the entire three-hour opera, or however long it is. It is quite beautiful, and I just wonder, in terms of putting together a concert where you're trying to cheat people into classical music. I mean, one of the things that is an obstacle is that, you know, there's so much of it, and it seems to require an education before you can even feel comfortable for a lot of people. How do you decide what are the pieces to start with if you're trying to initiate the uninitiated?
Well, the attempt in this concert on June the 17th, next Sunday, is to break down the criticism about classical music, that everything too darn long, and that's certainly the criticism about opera, is that they're just too darn long, and the good bits are just too far apart. So what I'm planning on doing in this concert is we're trying to, how do you choose? I went to the top 40. I went and Googled, what is the top 40 in classical music? And out of the top 40, I picked 19, and I've truncated them into 3 minutes. So we're going to do 3 minutes of Beethoven 9, so and 3 minutes of Beethoven 5, and 3 minutes of Romeo and Juliet. So in some ways, it's a little like tapas. You know, it's a kind of... if there's something you don't like, you won't hear it for very long. And if there's something you do like, then, you know, you'll get 3 minutes of it and go buy the record or come and hear us play the whole piece later on. But I think part of the problem for the person that doesn't is uninitiated in classical music, it takes them so long to get through the repertoire that they're supposed to know. You know, just to listen to the 9 Beethoven symphonies and all of the top 40 would take you about 60, you know, probably 40 hours, shall we say. Well, that's a long time, and that's a lot of listening to have to go through just to get to the point where you've listened to the top 40. So my point is, here, come to this concert, you can hear the top 40 in 90 minutes. And it's just really a way to say that classical music doesn't have to be long-winded and as threatening and as unengaging as we could make it by just giving you the greatest hits. But even the greatest hits, I mean, Beethoven 9 is 90 minutes long.
Right.
You either get the one piece, or we can give you part of it, and remind you to say, oh yeah, that really is a great tune, because even 3 minutes of Beethoven can show you the wealth of greatness there. I don't think you have to listen to 90 minutes of Beethoven 9 to know that it's a masterpiece. Or Mozart or Rachmaninoff. I mean, very quickly you can tell a great pop song from a bad one. And I think the same with classical music.
Although some might ask the opposite question of if 3 minutes is enough to get the greatness, why listen to the whole 90 minutes at all, right?
Well, I think that's one of the questions that a lot of people, conductors are asking themselves. The problem is that, you know, we are what we are. The composers have given us the masterpiece. You know, it's like saying, well, I'll only give you one half of the Mona Lisa's face. Will it be as beautiful a picture? Yeah, there will be a beautiful half face, but it's the whole thing that eventually... let's say, take Beethoven 5 in example, you know, which is 40 minutes long. There are four different movements in it, and the interspersement and the balance between those four movements that make it great. But of course, the first movement is what we all hear, and in fact, you know, John Belushi just gave us, you know, the first 20 seconds of it, and that's what we kind of think of. Beethoven 9, it's all about the Ode to Joy. Unfortunately, there are 68 minutes before we even get to the Ode to Joy. So I don't think that we have to say, well, it's either one or the other, because the whole point is to get your feet wet. It's like golf. You know, I'm a golfer, and do we say that it's only worth being a golfer if you can score 72? You know, the joy of golf comes from the possibility that you might just hit one great shot, you know, to make that whole day worthwhile. And the same about classical music. You may just hear 3 minutes that make that whole experience worthwhile.
Right. Jennifer, is this a similar approach to what you all are taking down in Knoxville?
It is, and I think the question that you asked actually before the musician's performance is a very important one. You said, what are we listening for in this particular piece of music? And one of the ways that we have tried to kind of distill classical music down is through the use of technology. On our 4th of July concert last year, we actually used a program that works like a Twitter feed, so we could pull out those specific moments in the music where we really wanted people to focus on a particular instrument or a particular melody that was happening, or just to give them some kind of interesting historical context, or, you know, a fun fact about the piece. So I think part of our jobs as musicians and as conductors and as educators in the symphony realm is to pull out those things that people might find the most interesting or the most engaging, and just to give them a couple of those guideposts as they're listening.
And how did you do that? Was it projected somewhere in the venue, or did people have little devices that they were following along?
It actually worked with smartphone technology, so that you could follow our feed that we were doing and get these updates as the music was going along right on your smartphone.
Wow. And was there something to block the signal so people's phones didn't start ringing in the middle of all that?
In this particular venue, it's a giant outdoor venue in the middle of World's Fair Park. We actually had the World's Fair in Knoxville in 1982. And so it's not as much of a distraction in that venue because we are in such a large and open space.
Fascinating. And how did people respond to that?
It was the first time we had tried it, and we had a good following. I would say we had 40 and 50 followers, which we thought was great for our first time doing this kind of thing. We do have the technology to do large screens in that particular venue, and so I think going forward using that technology, that's something we will explore to make sure that it's accessible to everyone who's there.
Interesting. I've got to break in here and remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the Hot Summer Nights music series and classical music performance in Columbia. Joining me in the studio is Kirk Trevor, music director and conductor for the Missouri Symphony. On the phone we have Jennifer Barnett, director of education and community partnerships for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. We're going to have to take a break here for a minute for station ID, but we hope that you'll stick around and join us. Feel free to call in 882-8925 and we'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the Hot Summer Nights music series and classical music performance in Mid-Missouri. Joining me in the studio is Kirk Trevor, the music director and conductor for the Missouri Symphony. And on the phone we have Jennifer Barnett, director of education and community partnerships for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. For those of you in our audience, how accessible do you think classical music is for people in our community? share your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Before the break, we were talking about an experiment that Knoxville had done with sending messages out, and Jennifer mentioned that they had big screens behind the orchestra that they could project things on. Let's talk about that a little bit, that idea of music with visuals. Kirk, what's your experience or your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think that we've become a very visual society, even, you know, in everything that we do now. The visuals are there for obviously for pop concert, but I think more and more so with classical orchestras are understanding that there's a visual element there that can be highlighted and amplified, shall we say. So obviously big screen, the Philadelphia Orchestra tried it during major subscription concerts of having little cameramen in black, you know, who were doing close-ups of instruments as they were being played and players so that people could see the real facial expression of players when they're playing Beethoven or Mahler. But I think that some people found that disturbing, you know, because unfortunately a big visual behind an orchestra takes away from what the orchestra is doing en masse and maybe disturbs your ability to listen in the same way. However, with education programs, I think, you know, you can balance it a little better because kids are so visual. They haven't learned yet how to be orally oriented. They've certainly learned how to be visually oriented. And I think that if you can blend visual with oral for young children in education programs, and certainly I know from my experience of starting the STV series for junior high program, junior high kids in Knoxville, where we worked with MTV and did a lot of visuals along with classical music, that you can engage kids that way. Not that we should be attempting to dumb down to them, but we do know that the attention span of the average sixth grader is about 4 minutes and 23 seconds. Does that mean that you should play a 40-minute Beethoven symphony and expect them to appreciate it the same way? I think not. I think we have to find a way to reach them and to engage, entertain, and then educate.
Right, those three things all together.
To me, in that order, but Jennifer may have a different view about
Jennifer,
what it should be.
I mean, that's a good question. Jennifer, what has your experience been like trying to get kids into the symphony?
Mm-hmm. We do use visuals on almost all of our education concerts. Now, we're working with mostly elementary age students, and so for that particular demographic, I think that it's a very valuable tool. And we use it not only to show them close-ups of individual musicians as they're playing, but also just to provide information. Whether that be the name of the piece that the orchestra is currently playing, the composer, we have, you know, visuals that go along with the place that a particular piece of music originated from. But we have found the same thing. It's very important to turn those visuals off. I found myself even sitting in the audience in some of these concerts that I was watching the screens. I wasn't actually watching the live performance that was happening on stage. And so we try to use those very strategically. If we have a particular concept that we've talked about in conjunction with a piece, we'll highlight that on the screen. But we make sure in every piece of music that we play that those screens are off at some point so that attention is directed back to the live music that's happening in front of them.
It's an interesting dilemma, though, because you want to focus attention on the key moments of the music, but you need the screens to kind of direct people that's the key moment, right? So how do you sort that out?
Especially at that age group. We work with a group of educators here in Knoxville, and so we try to tie what we're doing in the concerts very closely to what they're teaching in their curriculum in the classroom, and so we choose those moments based on what the students have studied in their classroom already. It's more of a meaningful educational experience for them if they've studied that in advance, and then they come and have it reinforced at the concert, and then they talk about it again afterwards in their classroom afterwards. So we try to just pick those key moments that they've learned a little something about to highlight during the concert.
Right. Okay, we have a couple of callers on the line. I want to bring them into the conversation. We'll go one at a time. First, we'll bring William in. William is from Waynesville. William, are you with us?
Yes, I'm right here.
Great. Thanks for joining the program today and for calling in.
Yes, absolutely.
Go ahead.
I was just listening, and I was doing my homework today, and so I turned on the radio, and I put on NPR, and your program came on, and so I finished my homework, and I thought I called.
Great.
And so I did. And I would just like to comment on your, your earlier statements of how children and classical music today aren't really getting together that much. I am the only child in my school that listens to classical music. It's the other man, I'm sorry, I forget his name, said it's a beautiful artistic thing. You learn to appreciate it just like any other piece of beautiful art.
Right. William, how old are you?
I'm 15.
15. And what grade does that put you in?
I'm actually about to become a junior.
Uh-huh. And how were you connected to classical music? Like, where did you first hear it or learn about it?
Just regularly on the radio. But my family, they just had some classical music CDs lying around and just some piano music CDs. And I listen to that when I usually go to sleep or if I'm doing work. It's soothing and it focuses.
Right.
Do you play anything, William?
I do not. I'm actually, though, training to become a chef. That is my passion, is food.
Cool.
And what do you... I just love music.
What do your friends say when you tell them that you like classical music?
They say that it's odd, that it's silly, it's not good, but
you're not
they
cool.
Don't have to listen to it.
And how do you, I mean, Kirk and Jennifer, how do you break that down? I mean, when there is the rare person like William who at an early age connects with classical music, everyone around them is giving them that kind of a message. How do you address that in terms of supporting people like William who actually are exposed at an early age?
Obviously, you know, my first thing would be to try and get William closer to live music and invite him to come and listen to the orchestra play live and sit on the stage and have that experience, not just listening to NPR, which, you know, we know as well is maybe a dying breed as well, you know.
Let's hope not, right?
No, but let's hope not. But certainly, you know, if you know that there are young people out there, you want them to become advocates. And if William would be a wonderful advocate for us in classical music in this town, so I would, you know, nurture him and champion him and give him more experiences so that, you know, he becomes even more of an advocate. So that would be my thing and, you know, maybe go to his school and talk to some of the people that don't think he's cool.
Jennifer, what do you think?
We have a wonderful program here in Knoxville that we started a couple of years ago through our county government, and it's called Penny for the Arts, which allows any student that is in our county or in our county school system to attend certain arts events for free. And at the Symphony, we have added our Masterwork series and our Chamber series onto that. So I think one of the important things is just making those accessible. So, you know, any student has access to classical music that wants to get more involved. And then we also try to take those students that show a natural interest anyway and provide programs that are serving their needs. So, for instance, students that are already playing instruments through their band or their orchestra program, we have a side-by-side program that works with public education orchestras and bands to give them the opportunity to work with symphony musicians. And then we also promote our own youth orchestra so that any students that are working with string instruments or orchestral instruments have a venue that they can go and perform in and be with those other students few and far between that are like them.
In fact, our own conservatory program here is based on the youth orchestra program I started in Knoxville back in 1988 when we took the junior strings program that the university had run and incorporated them into our youth orchestra program in Knoxville. And that's what I tried to establish here back 5 years ago when we looked at creating a conservatory program and enabling young, talented musicians to be involved closely with musicians at the Missouri Symphony. We have a side-by-side program coming up on July the 1st from our Strings and Things camp, and they'll be playing with the orchestra on July the 1st so that we try and inspire them by having the ability not only to play in public but to play next to great professional musicians. I think we all in the symphony world are so involved in nurturing the talent like William and young performers today. We have these three or four demographics, as Jennifer probably well knows. We're trying to do a cradle-to-grave program that is truly overseeing the whole demographics of not only our community, but one of the things that we did a few years ago with the Missouri Symphony was work with Boone Hospital on doing a prenatal care program. In fact, we were thinking of before the cradle to grave program, in which we did a CD called Soothing Sounds of the Classic, which was going to be given rather like the state of Georgia did, give expectant mothers classical music for their children to listen to while they were in the womb. So we've done that program too, and so we're always looking at every kind of demographic age group, whether it's kindergarten through sixth grade, or whether it's seventh through 12th grade, or whether it's university students here in Missouri, you know, the 30-something. I mean, we've categorized. How many categories are there, Jennifer? You know, it gets to be so many, but in many ways, you have a different approach to all of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. William, are you still with us?
Yes.
What do you think of all this? I mean, does this give you a good sense?
Come to our concert, really, William, and great. Introduce yourself, and I'll take you backstage.
Go ahead, William, please.
I think it's really great that youth and older people can get together and share experiences. It just passes down knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the concert hall is a wonderful place when you see, you know, a young 16-year-old sitting next to an over 60-year-old and, you know, listening to the same piece and enjoying it, hopefully, with smiles on their faces. I think that's one of the great things about a concert hall that maybe I think we have a misconception about the concert hall that we think that it's only blue hair, and it really isn't. I think that, you know, it's just, again, the preconception out there that classical music is somewhat elitist and only people over 70 listen to it. The truth is, our listeners now know that there are 16-year-olds listening to classical music and listening to the radio.
Yeah. Well, William, I want to thank you very much for being part of the conversation
today.
Absolutely.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah, and take care. And as Kirk said, I mean, if you make it to one of the performances in Columbia, look him up.
I would love that.
Great. Great. I want to bring on another caller. Again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. We're talking about classical music in mid-Missouri and the Hot Summer Nights Music Festival. We have another caller on the line, Bill from Columbia. Bill, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks for joining the program and for calling in today.
Well, happy to do it. The program is very interesting.
Well, thank you.
Just a couple of comments, if I may. First of all, I ran the University Concert Series for about 25 years, so I've sort of been in the business for a while.
Okay, so you know what you're talking about. This is great.
Anyway, the couple of things that we did that paid off, I thought, rather well. One was we got a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts to hire an audience educator. And so almost before every single concert, the audience members could go to the Fine Arts Recital Hall and hear a preview there, lasting usually about 40, 50 minutes, and then at 8 o'clock, they go into the concert over in Jesse, and they were given examples of music, historical backgrounds, parts of the music was played, all sorts of things were done. It was incredibly successful. We had about 200 people in the Fine Arts Recital Hall before every concert, and I think that one way of expanding the audience is to create a more knowledgeable audience, and so anything that enables people to know more about the music they're hearing, more often than not, adds to their enjoyment. So audience education, I think, is a big part of this.
Right. And was that somebody, an outside educator or expert, or was that somebody from within the symphony? Because, the St. Louis Symphony, David Robertson, the conductor there, comes out before the performances and does a similar thing.
And I do it in Indianapolis as well, yeah.
Well, this was a musicologist on the faculty of the university.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
And It really went extraordinarily well, and the same individual wrote marvelous sets of program notes for each concert, and I think it added just immeasurably. But let me add another angle to all this.
Okay.
It's interesting these days that symphony audiences, I'm sorry to say, are in decline, whereas museum audiences seem to be in a very substantial increase. And you have to ask yourself the question, well, why is that? I think part of the reason is you can go to the museum at 10 o'clock in the morning, you can go to the museum at noon, you can go to the museum at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you can sit before a painting for a minute, or you can sit before the painting for an hour. You can walk around, you can go get a bite to eat, you can come back and revisit it. And museums and galleries and that sort of thing are highly accessible, highly flexible, and you can kind of come at them as it is convenient to you. And I think accessibility is one of the major themes for everything these days, education included. Is it really the case that every time we hear classical music performed live, it has to be in a hall and over a certain period of time, usually an hour and a half or two? I find it interesting the New York Philharmonic has late afternoon concerts at 5 o'clock, and they're often just one work in length. So there are all kinds of variations here that I think would make this more accessible. And thirdly, obviously, to go back to the education point, it's what happens in the schools and how students are trained. And we all know that arts programs aren't exactly richly supported these days. And the more you get the students as they are young, the better the audiences are going to be in their development as they get older. It's an interesting thing.
Okay. Well, hang on, Bill. I want to give our panelists a chance to respond because you're bringing up some very good ideas here. The classical music happy hour, a 5 o'clock concert with one piece. I mean, how viable would that be for the Missouri Symphony or for the Knoxville Symphony to take on things like that? I mean, what gets in the way of those kinds of programs?
Nothing really. I mean, we do it in Indianapolis. We do 5:30 and with cocktails beforehand, and those are called our happy hour concerts. And we've experimented with 5:30, 7:30, and 9:30. At night, so that people could have their dinner before they come to the concert, and then do a late night concert for an hour and a half, no intermission. I think he's right in the flexibility is the thing now. As I was mentioning earlier to somebody, that the whole concept of subscription programs has died. I mean, the Knoxville Symphony, I know, used to have a subscription series of, you know, maybe 12 classicals, and we had 6 pops. Now our focus is much more on making concerts individual events and not relying on that subscription base, because in fact, you know, people have so many things that they can choose from today, they're not willing to the same extent they used to be to just buy an 8 concert series in February this year that commits me to a date in May next year. They just say, you know, come next May, I want to see whether I'm interested in going to that concert. So I think we've had to make concerts a little more individual events. That means giving them either themes or having pre-concert chats, which I have always done. I did them in Knoxville, and I do them in Indianapolis. I don't do them here as much because of the way our hall is configured, and because our pop series, it probably wouldn't lend itself to so easily to have, you know, the Beatles talk about their stuff before they come and sing it. But I agree that the flexibility is important. You know, various times of concert is something that we're always working with. And I'm sure it's the same in Knoxville, Jennifer.
Yes, we are actually, we just instituted a new series for next year, which is based around our concertmaster. We have a brand new concertmaster here. He's going into his second season, and he is in his mid-20s and is sort of attracting a different demographic to the orchestra. So we wanted to do something focused around him. So we're, and more than time and flexibility, we're looking at location. That's actually going to be held at a local coffee shop downtown, so that it is, you know, a little bit more intimate experience for those that are interested. And it actually sold out within the first 2 months of putting it on the market, and we had to add a second night. So I do think that there is still some viability to subscriptions. It's just finding those kinds of things that people are interested in coming to. Yeah. And to respond to the caller's question, I think one of the biggest barriers to that flexibility is demographics. For what we have seen, when you try those different times of day to target different demographics, you're still running into the problem of young families with children that have specific meal times and specific bedtimes and specific school schedules and maybe their after-school activities. So I think it's all in experimenting and finding, you know, what works in each individual community.
Well, let's talk about that families thing, because that is a big push that a lot of orchestras are trying to get at.
Well, Hot Summer Night, too.
Yeah. Right.
We just had our first family concert last night, and it definitely a big focus of mine for the Missouri Symphony.
And so what are you doing to try to get families there? I mean, Jennifer just
listed
the obstacles,
right? We have a family series, so that obviously is on a Sunday afternoon. Hopefully that's a time that is feasible for parents with their 5 to 12-year-old children. We make the program, obviously, I want to use this, the 3 E's again, engaging, entertaining, and educational. Because I think parents would like to feel that a family concert has an educational element to it, so because that's the reason they want their kids exposed to classical music. But they also certainly want it to be entertaining for their kids and engaging. And we had Paul Pepper on the on our show yesterday. You take themes that are relevant to that age group, whether it's something that is on Little Einsteins or music that young children will have heard somewhere outside of the concert hall, maybe on cartoons or in television. At the same time, without dumbing down to young children, we still want them to understand what a symphony orchestra is and what it isn't. You know, a symphony orchestra is not a rock band and never will be, and it's not a cartoon band either. So, you know, we want to make sure that the integrity of the symphony is maintained, even within, you know, concerts that are geared toward families and young children. How do you get families into our traditional concert is a little harder, as Jennifer said, because of many other issues. So you can only experiment with times. But I think that the best way to get families involved is to have a series specifically for families. And I used to conduct the National Symphony in Washington on their very, very successful family series. And the way they made it successful is that the tickets were free, but by ballot. You applied to go to the Kennedy Center, and they sold the whole house out, and they were fantastic concerts, and you saw the whole demographics of Washington in front of you because the tickets were free. Obviously, for any orchestra, if there is funding in a way that enables the whole audience to be able to come for free, that's what we'd all like.
Right. Yeah. Bill, are you still on the line with us?
Yeah.
I stopped you, and you had another idea that you wanted to bring into our conversation
today.
Well,
let me just go back to one other thing. One of the most successful, if you want to use the word family, concerts ever was a series done by the New York Philharmonic and Leonard Bernstein, Young People's Concerts. I think they're still available on YouTube or something. And Bernstein was a marvelous audience educator, and he got those kids absolutely enthralled by this. I remember one program on Shostakovich's Fifth that was just stunning. So the idea that you can put a family together and have someone there trying to explain what the orchestra or soloists are doing and make it a family event is certainly a viable idea to this day. The other thing, though, which I just find incredible, is the use of the media for classical music. The basic example being the Metropolitan Opera broadcast that we get even here at Columbia in the Forum Theater on Saturday afternoons during the season. Seems to me that there are ways of tying live orchestral performances to those things at the movie theater, and maybe having a concert based on the opera that the people see in the theater and then go to the concert hall to hear some live selections from it.
They already do. The Los Angeles Philharmonic is on at the Forum as well.
Yes.
The same thing as a Metropolitan broadcast. And
those things, as far as I know, are very well attended. I just admire that as outreach. And, of course, that's accessibility once again.
Right. Well, Bill, I want to thank you for calling in and joining the conversation today. We really appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
Yeah. Kirk, we're getting close to the end of our show, but I want to ask you this. Our producer, Janet, Saidi is a big fan of what goes on. She takes her kids to the concerts, and you know, she's really interested and wants to know why you're working so hard to do this. I mean, her family benefits from this. Lots of other families are benefiting. What is it that gets you excited about getting families to the symphony?
Well, because I have a young family myself, so you know, I want to make sure that I have a concert for my own 6-year-old and 4-year-old that's worth them going to. But no, I mean, seriously, the reason is without young audiences of today, we will have no old audiences of tomorrow. So the earlier we can get young children into the concert hall and experience the beauty, the excitement, the energy, and it doesn't have to be the concert hall. Let's go back to Stevens Lake Park Amphitheater. There were more children at that performance than I've ever seen anywhere. Since I've been here in Colombia, there were children because they were picnicking and they were with their parents and running around on the grass, but they were listening to classical music and listening to a symphony orchestra. Why do we do this so much for families? Because I think that families that play together, stay together. Classical music is one of the great ways for families to engage with each other, learn instruments. My hope, of course, is that children that come to our concert like last night, who then went to the petting zoo afterwards, would see an instrument. They say, I want to play that. The parents who obviously took their children to a family concert are also engaged and obviously aware of the importance of culture and will hopefully, you know, follow through and give children lessons. And without performance, you know, there was a study made that said that the majority of people who go to symphony concerts were actually performers when they were younger, meaning that they played in the Mizzou band or they actually played an instrument at some time in their high school life and then, you know, at some point quit it. And I met so many people who've told me that story that the reality is that good listeners are usually proactive. They're people that have been proactive performers, and proactive performers become good listeners. So I think that the only thing that I disagree with Bill about a little earlier was that the Bernstein concert of the 60s were not necessarily a proactive audience. I found that a very passive form of listening, to Lenny, as wonderful as Lenny is, and in talking about music, it's still a passive form of listening. And I remember, you know, 30 years ago, the main thing that school music teachers, when they took their kid to young people's concert, they just didn't want any embarrassing thing to happen with their kid. No spitballs, don't make no noise, don't rustle paper. You know,
yeah. Don't clap between the movements.
You know, I want all of those things. You know, perhaps not the spitballs, but you know, if you have to rustle the program, it means you're looking at it. And if you clap between movement, you've been inspired. I think I want proaction rather than passivity.
Okay, that's a good place for us to stop here. We're pretty much out of time for today's conversation. I'd like to thank our guests, Kirk Trevor, music director and conductor for the Missouri Symphony. And on the phone, we had Jennifer Barnett, director of education and community partnerships for the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. Thanks also to the two members of the Missouri Symphony for their performance, Alexander Vyutsev. Am I even close? I'm not even close on that. Okay, there it is. And Maria Duhova-Trevor for their musical performance today. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of our program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar, Travis McMillan, our technical director, with production assistance from Danny Madison. Pat Akers is our audio producer. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.